You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello, and time now for this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North, and I'm joined again by Sarah Roberts and Dr. Matt Allen. Welcome both.
Hiya.
Hi.
So we've got some, we'll start off with some good news, the successful launch of BepiColombo. This is the European Space Agency's mission to Mercury, the innermost planet of the solar system. Sarah, what have you got for us on BepiColombo?
So, like you said, it was successfully launched last Saturday on the 20th, and now it's going to begin its long, looping, seven-year journey to Mercury. And essentially only the third mission to Mercury, if I'm correct. We've had NASA's Mariner 10 back in the 70s, and then we have MESSENGER, which had a mission life of around 5 years before it was retired in 2015. And now, of course, we have BepiColombo. Difficult one to say.
named after Giuseppe Colombo, who was the person who figured out that you could do these spiralling orbits to get into Mercury. Because one of the interesting things about this is the route it takes. It doesn't just, one does not simply fly to Mercury, right?
No, so it will be flying past Earth and Venus before it reaches Mercury itself in around 2025. So this is a joint mission between the European Space Agency and the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, or JAXA is easier to say. So like I said, it'll arrive around December 2025 when it will begin its first, its one-year mission. And hopefully it will answer a lot of outstanding questions. This is our least studied terrestrial planet. And one of the biggest mysteries surrounding Mercury is why its iron core is so big. So it represents about 60% of the planet's mass. And there's a theory that Mercury actually formed much further from the Sun than we see it today. And as it migrated towards the Sun, it was involved in a huge collision, which would explain how it lost its outer layers. Hopefully we can finally lay that question to rest. And it will study the planet using two orbiters. One was designed by JAXA, and that's the Mercury Magnetospheric Orbiter. That'll look at the surface and the interior. And then we've got ESA's Mercury Planetary Orbiter, which will look at the magnetic field and the atmosphere. And there's been some major UK contributions to that. We've contributed an X-ray instrument that'll look at the chemistry of the planet. But the UK also contributed large parts of both the orbiter and the spacecraft that will carry it to Mercury.
I was lucky enough to go and see BepiColombo in a lab once.
Oh,
so I went
cool,
saw
yeah.
it when it was being assembled in Airbus in Stevenage. I got to go into the clean room and see Bepi on its, or put the ESA orbiter on its stage. They gave it a twirl for us. We looked at some ion thrusters, some ion fuel tanks, and so xenon fuel tanks rather for the ion engine. It was good fun. It's big. It's several meters across. But
wow.
Looked very fancy. They have to shield it quite carefully as well. Right? You're getting that close to the Sun, you have to be really careful
yeah,
with the heat.
Yeah, huge amounts of heat and radiation could be a bit of a danger to spacecraft. So, yeah. Must be.
Anyway, so don't hold your breath. 2025 is when it gets there, but maybe we'll get a snapshot of Earth as it swings by in about, I think, is it 18 months, I think it swings by Earth? So we get a maybe
in 2020,
Yeah, so we get a shot of Earth maybe if its cameras are working. It's released a photo of its solar panels, so we know they're deployed, which is a key part of any spacecraft. So it's become a routine thing of taking photos of spacecraft up in space.
Spacecraft selfies.
In other missions, we've got Hayabusa 2, which is the another Japanese mission to an asteroid. This is going to asteroid Ryugu. And one thing that has done is released two rovers and then a third rover. So a French-German rover called Mascot, which has gone down to the surface, taken images. The previous rovers called Minerva have released little movies of sunrise and sunset and so on. So there's been a few things out of those. No doubt we'll get results in due course. Moving somewhat further afield, we've got an astronomical lookalike. And this is a lookalike of an event that took place last summer, so August 2017. We had a binary neutron star, which was the first ever co-detection of gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves, or light, from one event, now known to be the collision of two neutron stars that have been spiraling in and then merged, releasing huge amounts of energy. And Matt, there's something that looks not dissimilar has been found.
Yeah, so they've actually, the event that they found recently actually goes all the way back to 2015, where astronomers found this bright flash of gamma rays, so what we would now know as a gamma ray burst. And they saw this using several different telescopes. They've actually seen it in gamma rays, and they also saw it follow up in X-rays and in optical light as well. But the really interesting thing is it looks very similar to, as you said, the gravitational wave discovery that happened last year. And so everyone's getting quite excited because we think that these are probably the same two events because they look very similar. Kind of makes sense that these two things are both from neutron star mergers. But what's really useful actually is that one of the ways that we saw this gamma ray burst last time was with LIGO, so we saw the gravitational waves of it, but actually this time around it's much further. So at the time, actually in 2015, LIGO was actually down for maintenance and upgrades anyway, but it turns out that it wouldn't have been able to see it because it was much too far away for LIGO to be able to see it. So we actually now have this this other event that we've seen. And the reason we can see it is as these two neutron stars merge together, we think that they release this bright jet of high energy particles, which creates this kind of short gamma ray burst that we can see in the sky. So yeah, it's kind of a really nice independent way of also finding another gamma ray burst, which we think is, from all evidence, looks very similar to what we've seen before. So we think we've seen another evidence of these two neutron stars merging with each other.
One of the nice things you can do with gravitational wave data from LIGO and Virgo and so on, is you can go back through the data and look for previous events. Although, as you say, 2015, the detector was down for maintenance and improvements. But in the future, if there are any of these events found, they can go back and look through archives and so on. Even if they're not seen as they happen, they might be quite faint.
Yeah. And it's really useful, actually, to also look back at the data using the gravitational waves, using LIGO and the detectors, because there are certain things like the mass of the two objects, which we think we can actually get from using the data from LIGO, but we can't actually get from just the optical and all the other kind of electromagnetic radiation as well. So it's really nice to be able to go back, if it was possible, to get that data on the gravitational waves from LIGO so that we can actually work out the masses of what these two objects were, so we can understand a little bit more about them as well.
Getting two neutron stars together and to be able to produce these mergers that create these big explosions is one of the mysteries of these events, to figure out how common they are, how often does that happen. And Sarah, there's been a discovery of that maybe highlights how this could take place.
Yeah, so like you said, it's not just the collision of two neutron stars that is energetic. Also the creation of these stars is also extremely energetic. Neutron stars are created when a massive star explodes as what we call a supernova, and these are some of the most violent and energetic explosions in the universe, and they actually send most of the star's material blasting into space. However, in the case of neutron stars, the core is left behind, and this is what becomes the neutron star. But in a binary system where we have two neutron stars gravitationally bound together, we'd expect that when the second massive star went supernova, it would actually make the system too unstable to continue, rather than creating a binary system of neutron stars. So this has been a big mystery for a while. Of course, we know that they exist. We've seen two neutron stars collide. And now we might know why this is or how they come to exist. Scientists have theorized something called an ultra-stripped supernova. So the idea here is that when the first system, or when the first star turns into a neutron star, it begins stripping material from its partner. And this isn't very unlikely. Neutron stars have notoriously strong gravity, about 2 billion times stronger than the gravity on Earth. So it's likely that they'll be stealing material from the partner star. And the idea is that they steal so much material that by the time the second star goes supernova, it has far less material. So a far less energetic explosion will take place, meaning that the system can continue. They'll still be gravitationally bound together. So after theorizing this, they began scouring through archive data from a collection of telescopes in California, and they think that they've actually spotted one of these ultra-stripped supernova. So it looks likely that this is how it happens, this is how they form.
Okay, so the one big supernova and then a slightly quieter, fainter supernova.
Exactly,
a little while,
yeah.
Afterwards. Okay, interesting. So as we discover more of these, then maybe we'll get better ideas of how they form. Now, we've talked about robotic probes going to Mercury and asteroids and so on, but there have been some crewed missions as well. We have people who live up on the International Space Station and are living up there, operating the space station, doing all sorts of experiments. Now and again, additional people go up, and there was actually a launch failure of a crewed mission up to the space station earlier this month. This was a crewed mission that launched on a Soyuz rocket, a Russian rocket, up to the space station, and actually about 2 minutes in, failed. Now, it wasn't a massive explosion. No one died. Both astronauts on board are actually absolutely fine, by all reports. It looks like one of the booster rockets didn't separate properly and maybe broke up as it separated, which meant that the second stage didn't fire and so on. The astronauts ejected using, well, they didn't eject quite like you might imagine from a plane, but a little booster takes their top capsule and then safely lands them a little bit further away. But a fairly hair-raising experience, I imagine.
Yeah, imagine it must be quite kind of scary, but at least everything worked, and obviously shows that all the kind of the safety backups and everything are working and keeping everyone safe, which is reassuring.
Yeah, this has happened. I think there was an incident in the 70s, maybe, where something happened, where something went wrong with a rocket while it was still on the launch pad, and the astronauts then managed to use the same mechanism to eject. I think it's largely automated that it detects something is really wrong and sends them safely away. So the implications for the space station are that if there's no astronauts to go and replace them, no additional Soyuz craft to go there, that's how astronauts get back down. And so the one Soyuz craft there has got to come down in the next few months before it reaches the end of its usable life. So there is a small chance, although hopefully it won't happen, a small chance of having to temporarily abandon the space station.
Will that be the first time it's been left unmanned?
I think so. It's the first time it won't have anyone on it since it was launched. It was completed in 2013 or something, finally, but it's been up there since the last 20 years. It would be not a good thing to leave it without anyone on board to fix anything. They can do a fair bit remotely, I'm sure. So fingers crossed that doesn't happen. They figure out what went wrong and get more launchers going. Clearly, they need to get that figured out before they stick more people on top of a big rocket. Figure out why it went wrong. We've got other things that have had failures as well, this time with no people on board. We've got the Hubble Space Telescope, the most famous telescope, arguably, not on the Earth, but just above the Earth. The Hubble Space Telescope takes amazing pictures of the cosmos. It's been up there for 28 years, launched in 1990, so it's been up there a long time. Had a few repair missions over its life, and Matt, it's just had a close escape from having to stop working, essentially.
Yeah, so one of the gyroscopes actually on Hubble broke recently, and so the gyroscopes are these kind of spinning wheels, essentially. They spin about 20,000 times every single minute, and they're measured to see kind of the orientation in which they're spinning around, and by measuring this we can work out basically where Hubble is looking, which is really important. Obviously, when you're turning Hubble to look at different points of the sky, you need to know where it's looking, so you know that when you're taking pictures of the right thing. But unfortunately, one of the gyroscopes actually broke a couple of weeks ago, and what this does is it puts Hubble into a safe mode, which means that the kind of normal observations sort of stop working, and so everything is trying to be repaired. Thankfully, it's almost kind of a nice process in which if one of the gyroscopes breaks, they can just use another one instead. But unfortunately, there seems to be some problems with one of the backup gyroscopes as well. So it was all a little bit of a trouble at a time. The good news is that it all seems to be working, and the backup gyroscope now, which seems to be just recording two high values, actually seems to be working again. So they're going to run it through some tests. They're going to make sure that everything is okay. And then hopefully soon it'll go back into normal science mode. But there are actually six gyroscopes that were reinstalled in 2009, which I found out. And so when they were reinstalled, they thought that this would last for about 5 years, I think, before those gyroscopes would kind of reach the end of their life. And they're now working on, they now have three working gyroscopes left. And it really needs three to be working at top performance. So if one more goes, it starts getting a little bit trickier. NASA do say there are some ways to get around not having three gyroscopes working on board. But it sort of then starts limiting the lifetime of Hubble, because they probably won't be replaced again. So this is possibly the reason why Hubble will stop working, in a sense.
Yes, this could be the reason, I suppose. The gyroscopes, I mean, if you've ever played with those spinning toys where you wrap a string around it, pull it really, really fast, and the little gyroscope starts spinning on the table, and it always ends up orienting itself normally straight up, and then maybe sort of processes around a little bit. So the gyroscopic effect is something that even small children are in principle familiar with. If you only have two, I think you can't point it so accurately, so it means some of the measurements of things like exoplanets and so on, where you need to be very accurately located on the sky, get a bit more tricky. But yeah, as you say, it sounds like it's coming back to life, as it were. There've been a few other near misses as well. Chandra, an X-ray satellite, a NASA X-ray satellite, had a potential gyroscopic failure, but they're now using a backup. The Curiosity rover on Mars had a memory glitch, stopped reporting science data to its memory, stopped uploading science data. They switched to a backup computer. Actually, they were on the backup computer. They switched to the main computer, which broke about 6 months after its mission started. Or after its landing, and they've now fixed that main computer, and they're back to that one. Opportunity on Mars is yet to phone home after a big dust storm that blotted out the sky, so hopefully Opportunity will be able to speak home. Hopefully that isn't the end of its long, long mission. Fingers crossed that does speak to us again. And the Kepler mission, an exoplanet mission from NASA, is also nearing the end of its life. It's running out of fuel, so you do need thrusters to be able to orient Kepler. That had a gyroscopic failure as well. That had gyroscopes that stopped working, and so they start using the radiation pressure from the sun. They're essentially sailing Kepler to be able to point it, which is quite good fun. But they do need thrusters to keep pointing it now and again. They managed to point it back at Earth to get its data back, and they've started the next month, but every time there's increasing chance that it'll run out of fuel and then not be able to point back towards Earth. So Kepler's had a good run as well. It's been up there for quite a number of years now as well. That sounds like it's a list of failures up in space, but we had some good stories about Bepi Colombo and Hayabusa and stuff as well, and the Parker Solar Probe as well on its way to the sun. So there have been a few successes up in space. We've also got upcoming telescopes down on the ground. One of the telescopes that's talked about a lot is something called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. It's going to be a very big telescope, 8 meters across, so not as big as the massive behemoths that are being planned for decades' time. And it's due for first light for the start of operations in a few years' time, but plans are underway for what will be done with it by astronomers all around the world. A very ambitious project to look at the sky again and again and again and again, to take a snapshot of the sky, a survey of the sky over the course, a time-lapse image of the sky, if you like, over the course of days, and keep running for years. I thought it'd be a good time to find out more about the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope and what it's going to change for the field of astronomy. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Amanda Bauer, who's the Head of Education and Public Outreach at the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. So, Amanda, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, first of all, Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, as well as being a mouthful of a name, it's it's an ambitious project to run as well as pronounce. What's the idea of the project? What's it going to do?
Yeah, it is an incredibly ambitious project, starting with building the largest digital camera ever built for astronomy, which will sit on a large 8-meter telescope in the Andes Mountains in Chile, and it will look at the entire southern sky every 3 or 4 nights. So every few nights it covers the whole sky, and it does this over and over again for 10 years. So what we're tracking is the motions and changes of tens of billions of stars and galaxies, other kinds of objects, and ultimately creating kind of the largest time-lapse movie of the universe. Slightly ambitious.
It's certainly an exciting thing to try and do. So when we look up at the sky, things mostly seem the same. The planets move around and so on. But what kind of things are you looking at changing on the timescale of a few nights?
Yeah, so there are things that move in the solar system. When you have such a large telescope, you can see fainter objects farther away. So we have a pretty good idea of the asteroid belt that lives between Mars and Jupiter, but there's asteroid belts that live farther out in the solar system that we don't really know that much about. So by looking at how things change on a scale of just a couple days and watching them over and over, you start to understand their trajectory. Because it's such a big, sensitive telescope, you can start to understand the compositions of those objects. And so that gives you a hint as to how the solar system actually formed.
The biggest telescopes we have on the planet at the moment are about 8 meters, 8 to 10 meters across. So it's not actually much bigger than the NOES telescope. So you might say, well, okay, if we're building a telescope that's kind of the same as the others, then why is that ambitious? What in
right.
particular, you mentioned the camera. Is it the camera that's new?
So it's a combination of the camera and also the quickness with which the telescope moves and the amount of sky that this telescope can capture within one image. So in a single image, it can cover the area on the sky of about 40 full moons, which is huge. And then very quickly, it can move to the next point of the field. So you take one snapshot that looks at 40 full moons, and then that lasts about 30 seconds. And then within a few seconds, you move to the next area of the sky and you take another snapshot. And so quickly you can cover a huge chunk of the sky, which is why we can get the entire southern hemisphere every few nights. It's really incredible.
And to put it into context, when you look at images that are from the Hubble Space Telescope, the flagship project in astronomy, when that takes its camera and looks at the sky, it's looking at a tiny, certainly the old images are something like the size of a pinhead held at arm's length in terms of the air. They were really small. So this is orders of magnitude larger. This is much, much, much bigger, right?
Oh, absolutely. Those looked at just a fraction of the size of the moon in the sky. And this is pack 40 full moons right next to each other. It's big. What comes along with having such a huge image is that you want to process that data very quickly. So the other part of what this telescope is producing is once it looks at the sky, it subtracts a template. So it's kind of what's the average sky look like, and then let's subtract that and see everything that's gotten brighter or fainter or has moved. It processes that and then sends out an alert for every single thing that has changed in that area of the sky within 1 minute of it being observed. So on average, we're expecting to send out something like 10 million alerts a night for things that have changed their position, gotten brighter, gotten fainter. That is a lot of processing, and that's a lot of new information about the universe.
That's a lot of things. So you send out alerts saying that here's 10 million things that have got brighter or fainter or moved or whatever. What is the rest of the astronomical community going to do with that information on the timescale of minutes?
That's a good question. I think people are getting themselves prepared for that right now. I can imagine a network where you sort of automatically parse through that alert and you say, oh, this is something that needs to be followed up. This is very exciting. And so they automatically ping another telescope to do a bit of a longer follow-up observation to try to get a little bit more information about what that object might be or how it's changing.
Okay, so you can do things very, very quickly from other telescopes and catch them as well. You mentioned looking at asteroids and other objects out in the solar system. What are the other sort of main science goals of the project?
So we are looking at the Milky Way galaxy, so the galaxy that we live in. We're trying to survey a huge area, so 20 million stars that live in our galaxy, to try to understand the motions of these stars and how it actually formed. Dark matter and dark energy, so understanding gravitational lensing events where distant galaxies are kind of lensed by nearby galaxies in multiple ways. And so this survey will detect more gravitational lenses than have ever been known before. And dark energy, you need a lot of galaxies observed in lots of different parts of the sky in order to understand the subtle measurements you need to take to figure out what dark energy is, which is what's causing our universe to expand.
All right, so an awful lot of that's a huge range of science, as you'd expect from a big project like this. It's going to do a lot of different things, and I guess there's all the things as well. Serendipitous is normally the word used. So things that sort of crop up by accident that you didn't expect to see. Must be a major target.
We can only make the best guesses about what we're going to see, especially with the changing sky, because we've never observed things over and over and over. For instance, I did my research on my last research project on 300,000 galaxies, but I only had one single snapshot of each of those galaxies. So what if there's a flare-up of the supermassive black hole at the center? I wouldn't catch that because I only see it one time. So all of these things, we can make good guesses as to what we're going to find, but I think we're going to uncover a whole other side of the universe that we really don't know about right now.
Now you can build a telescope, you can put the camera on it. You said it's the biggest camera ever built. How big is big?
It's about the size of a car.
Wow.
It's like an SUV-sized camera that's going to sit on the front of the telescope. The entry lens into the camera is 5 feet tall. It's just almost as tall as I am. So that's just a lens. That's not even the 8-meter mirror. It's a huge camera.
Wow, that's a big lens to stick on a camera. I'd have trouble pointing that at the daffodils in the garden. So that's the thing that lets it view a large area of the sky, just the size of the lens and the size of the detectors behind. How many pixels are we talking?
This is a 3.2 gigapixel camera.
So I'm used to looking at digital cameras, which are maybe, what, 10, 20 megapixels. That's millions of pixels. This is 3 billion pixels on the camera.
And ultimately, what that turns into is 20 terabytes of data per night that this telescope is going to collect, which is kind of more than the data that exists on the internet right now.
Wow.
And that's what we'll be collecting every night.
And again, so I have a fairly big hard drive in my laptop. It's 1 terabyte. So that's every night you need to go out and buy 20 laptop hard drives.
Yeah, every night for 10 years.
Okay, and so presumably you're not going to just go to the local shop and buy hard drives every night. How do you deal with that amount of data?
Absolutely. There is a national computing facility that's located near Chicago in Illinois, which is who we're working with. And so there's another redundant facility in France, and there's also one in Chile close to where the telescope is. So these facilities are being, really, we're kind of developing the technology that we're going to need to handle this kind of data. The new aspect of LSST as well is usually people will take data and download it onto their local machine and use it, but that's not really possible when you're talking about 20 terabytes of data a night. So part of what LSST is delivering is a software system where astronomers can kind of log in and do all of their research and analysis within that computing resource at the national facility, and then they can publish their results from the work that they do online.
So now, I mean, astronomy has changed in the last 20 years and that you now don't tend to have to go to telescopes to take your data, to make your observations. You do all that remotely, typically, or a lot of that is done remotely. But now you don't even have to go anywhere to analyze your data. You just go online and do it all remotely on a computer somewhere else. That's the changing world of astronomy, I guess.
Yeah, and that's kind of something that we're trying to tap into as well with the education and public outreach program, is we're trying to allow teachers and the public access to data with interfaces that are all online. So it's kind of like you just go use a website in your classroom as opposed to the teacher having to download software and download data and maintain everything, because we know it gets out of date very quickly. So that's part of the program that I'm building, is how do we bring that to the public and not just astronomers?
And so on that public outreach front, you say you're going to give people access to the data. You know, if you take a given classroom with full of, you know, 12-year-olds or whatever, what are you, do you have views, or have you figured out what that classroom might do with the data, or is it completely up to them?
Well, they certainly have some freedom, but we are trying to develop a suite of activities that are based around the main science themes of LSST that I mentioned. And then we are building kind of interactive systems. So students are playing with the data, but they don't necessarily need to know code. They don't need to know any of that fancy stuff. They can interact with this widget and push a button here and there and maybe move a slider. They can build their own color images from the 6 filters that LSST has. They can explore the evolution of different kinds of stars. They can try to look, we kind of produce the maps of where the stars live in the galaxy, and then they can start to explore where stars are the most clumpy and dense, and really create their own idea of what the shape of the Milky Way is that we live in.
So you've got, and anyway, it's not just classrooms, right? Anyone can go and do that in principle. Anyone can go and look at the data and use this, I guess. So you've got a huge army of people out there who might be looking at the data.
Absolutely. So we're also developing citizen science projects with LSST data, and these can range from anywhere from looking for solar system objects to the gravitational lens to see some of the most distant galaxies that exist. And anyone in the world can go and contribute to the research that these citizen science projects allow.
And it's fair to say that citizen science has become more and more important as data has got bigger and bigger, as we've got more data from projects. So I guess LSST is the pinnacle of that at the moment in terms of data we're going to get. Is that fair? Do you think, this must be much bigger than other projects that have been run like this, I guess.
Absolutely. And so we're working right now on that infrastructure for how you get the data into a citizen science project. At the moment, the scientist would download data and then upload it to the citizen science website, which isn't really practical. So we're kind of building the infrastructure to make that much more seamless. And the other consideration is, you know, machine learning is becoming more and more sophisticated. And so what we're finding in the citizen science research is that a combination of machine learning and human review is the best way to get the science results that you want. Machine learning is great, but there's still things like when you have a faint object or asymmetries that the human eye is much better at seeing. So it's a good combination of both those things, and they're necessary when you still have so many objects that are coming out of LSST.
So what kind of timescale are we talking about for the project? It's being built at the moment in Chile, right?
Yeah, it's been in construction for, I guess, 4 years now, and we have another 3.5 to 4 years. So the first operations starts in October of 2022. So we'll start seeing all of those alerts, 10 million a night from that point on.
Okay, so that's a few years to wait. And give us a pitch for if I'm thinking about things I want to maybe get a class of school children to go and work on astronomy. What are they going to be able to do with this? Why should they go and look up LSST, or why should teachers start preparing to look up LSST data in 4 years' time to use their classroom, do you think?
Well, for teachers, the biggest benefit is that they don't have to download anything. They don't have to maintain anything locally. They don't have to get past their firewalls or anything like that. So it's essentially sending your students to a website where they can actually interact with a unique set of astronomy data, be it galaxies or stars or solar system objects. They can look for asteroids that exist in different parts of the solar system. So we're developing enough activities that teachers can really pick and choose what fits into their curriculum, and then very seamlessly bring it into their classroom. I think it's just a fascinating way young kids can use astronomy, real astronomy data, and do authentic activities without knowing anything about code if they don't want to. And then they're free to kind of dig deeper with these tools if they're curious.
That sounds like it'll be something for everyone in there in terms of the activities they can do. Dr. Amanda Bauer from the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The Large Synoptic Survey Telescope is certainly an ambitious project. So, Sarah, Matt, are you looking forward to LSST and what it starts in about 5 years' time or thereabouts?
Yeah, it'll be really exciting to see when the first results come out and what it can do.
And you can have lots of news stories to write.
I'm excited to see the educational implications of LSST.
Yeah, as Amanda said, lots of plans for the education and outreach plans as well. That's it for this month. My thanks to Amanda, Sarah and Matt. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Don't forget, you can find this episode and past episodes at pythagastro.uk, where you can also subscribe to the podcast.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.